Coming up today, Facebook has rolled out secret conversations to all its Messenger users. We chat to photographer Benedict Redgrove, who takes us on an unprecedented tour inside NASA for the latest issue. Fish have accents, apparently. And Google announced a host of new products at its Pixel launch event. I'm your host, Vicky Wollaston, and joining me today is the welcome return of Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
Right, straight on to a thing you've learned this week. Reynolds, hit me.
So I've learned that every century, about a millisecond is added to the length of the day. So basically, scientists looked at some coral reefs, which told them that 400 million years ago, Earth's days were only 22 hours long, and there are only over 400 days in a year. So they're getting longer, very, very slightly.
I could really do with some more time.
Yeah, well, you're getting some. Just hang on a few thousand centuries.
Million years. Amelia?
I found out that the mimic octopus can impersonate other species. I really love octopus and squid. They're definitely my favourite animals, so I was really excited to learn this. They change their skin colour and texture in order to blend in with their environment, so like algae, rock or coral, and they do this to elude predators.
Well, the thing I learnt this week is that at liftoff, the five F1 first stage engines on NASA's massive Saturn V rocket ignite and they produce 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Now, I learnt that while working on a gallery of images for Wired.co.uk. So they're taken from the latest issue. We worked with photographer Benedict Redgrove to get exclusive access inside NASA, and we have some amazing images. So there's Valkyrie humanoid, there's the Orion training capsules, there's even a look at the Saturn V rocket itself. And what it does, it all forms part of Redgrove's past and present dreams of the future project and his book. Now, this has been 6 years in the making. This project began in 2010, and it will culminate with the launch of the new Space Launcher System rocket in 2018. Then there'll be a major exhibition. So our latest issue showcases a 16-page portfolio of this project alongside a great, quite emotional essay by Astronomer Royal Lord Martin Rees about the future of space travel. So on to the first story of today, Google Pixel. So Google hosted its highly anticipated launch event this week. I went to a warehouse out in Shoreditch to play with some of the new phones, as well as its Daydream VR headset. Google also revealed more about its home speaker, which is designed to take on Amazon's Alexa, and it showed off its Google Assistant.
So we've had a few other high-profile phone releases recently. How does it compare? Are they any good?
Do you know what? They're okay. The hardware didn't wow me, and I put in my hands on review that I called it a bit lackluster, and I got a bit of criticism on Twitter about that actually, because they were saying, well, how can you say it's lackluster when it's an improvement? Yes, it is an improvement. So the camera is better. It's got a faster shutter than other smartphone cameras. The display is really good, but nothing stood out enough for me to go, well, what does separate this massively from the likes of the iPhone and the Samsung Galaxies and stuff like that?
Do you mean in terms of like design and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you could see on Twitter when the launch event was going off how many people were saying how much it looks like an iPhone, and it does look like an iPhone. What was quite funny at the event was how much shade Google was throwing Apple during some of its promo videos. I mean, in one bit it said, look how smooth the back is. We don't have this unsightly camera bump. And that's obviously taking direct aim at the likes of Apple and its iPhone 7 Plus. The phone comes in three colours. And this was, again, this I think this was a bit of a dig at Apple or those sorts of companies. It's really blue, very black, and quite silver.
Yeah, I think it was something along those lines. I did really like the really blue colour. And yeah, I thought it was quite funny that they were like playing on some of the elaborate descriptions that you do get for smartphone colours nowadays.
I thought it was really funny until they roll out their Daydream VR headset and they're called Slate, Snow and Crimson.
So I thought that was along the same lines. I thought that was still the tongue-in-cheek.
It could be either way, couldn't it? I think it...
Yeah. Because also snow, it doesn't look like white snow, really. It's kind of a stony colour. So I thought maybe that was still along those lines, but... I don't know.
Or maybe it wasn't, just went over my head.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it feels like a little bit, they can't have it both ways, really, can they? Like, that's what it seems to me. They can't do the kind of, like, pretentious naming and then be like, oh, yeah, by the way. So what did you like about the phone?
Well, it was the Google Assistant built in. So just to give you a bit of a recap, so Google historically has given the phones to other manufacturers to make. this year they've decided to bring it all in-house, and they made a big deal out of it, saying they now do the software and the hardware together, and it, by doing that means they have complete control. And what that means as well is that they really are they're really putting their software like fully ingrained into their phones. And obviously that means Android, which has always been the case, but they've added a Google Assistant built in.
What's exciting about the Google Assistant then?
Well, they announced, they actually have been talking about it for quite a long time. Google are one of the pioneers in terms of AI and leading the way in terms of smart assistants and things like that. When they announced Allo a couple of weeks ago, they built in a Google Assistant on that. And I tell you what, that assistant blew my mind. It is incredible how accurate that software is. And I used it for like a week on Allo. The reason I don't carry on using Allo is because none of my friends are.
Well, maybe I'm being silly here. Run me through, what is Allo?
So Allo is a messaging app that Google announced a couple of weeks ago. And it's designed to try and get you away from the likes of WhatsApp. But it's got this assistant built in. So you can go on there and you can message your friends, but it uses all this context, which is what they showed off at the event, actually. So one of the examples they did at the event is they were talking about Adele. And then they said, okay, how many Grammys has she won? And Google Assistant automatically knows that you're talking about Adele because you mentioned her before, whereas other assistants may not be that smart or use context in that way.
And one of the exciting things was that if you ask it if you're talking to your friend and you ask it a question, it responds in the messaging as well. Like they did that as part of the demonstration on at the event and on Tuesday, and I thought that was really cool. Instead of you having to be like, oh, let me just drag up another screen kind of thing in order to ask the question, it responded in it.
Like one of the examples at the event was, I want to book a table. So Matt, if I was talking to you on Allo or any Pixel phone with assistant built in, you would say, oh, I really fancy going to this restaurant. And okay, Google, book me a table at this restaurant. And it'll come up and it'll prompt you and say, would you like to book it using OpenTable? And you go, yeah. How many people? Two people. What time? You give it the time and it just goes and does it for you. You don't have to then look, you don't have to open another app. You don't have to do anything else. It does it all for you. So it's actually an assistant. Rather than just being an extension of the web, it feels like it's helping you. So another thing that Google announced at the event on Tuesday was the home speaker. Now, they've talked about, it wasn't brand new. We knew that the home speaker was coming because they announced it a couple of months ago. But it's aimed directly at the likes of Amazon and Alexa. And one of their examples that they did on stage is that it gives you this morning briefing. So you go and you go, OK, Google, morning. And it starts rattling off just going, morning, Vicky. If you left now, it would take you 59 minutes to get to work based on current traffic. The weather outside is such and such, but it may rain later, so don't forget to take an umbrella. At 5 o'clock, you have a meeting with Matt Reynolds. And also, don't forget to pick up such and such before you go to the shops later or feed the kids. And they use it. What was quite funny about the event is they said, well, if the president can get a morning briefing, why can't I? And although everyone laughed about it, I really liked that.
Definitely being told about the weather is really good, because I do try and make sure that I check the app, you know, in case I need my umbrella. We do live in England. So just getting that straight away, that is really exciting.
And I think the key with this is that, like I said, Google is pioneering this AI and this machine learning. But also they've got this knowledge graph. And that's what the Google Assistant uses, is this knowledge graph that it's been building and adding to for years and years and years. And if you think, Google obviously is a search engine, so they know what people are searching for and they know what's on there, and they've got all these algorithms in place already that can categorize it. So another example they gave at the show is, if Google doesn't actually know the answer directly, it will find a website with a snippet and it will say, well, according to Wikipedia, this is the answer to that question. And one of the examples was, how do I get red wine out of a carpet? So the home didn't just say, oh, you just need to put soda on it, or you just need to do X. It actually said step-by-step instructions and read it out to you. So
that's
it was so cool.
Yeah, everyone's going to need that on a Sunday morning.
So in terms of hardware, I have an iPhone. I don't think I'd necessarily leave to get a Pixel, because it is very similar. I certainly won't pay the £600 starting price for a Pixel if I've already got a phone that has very similar hardware. What does set it apart is the software, and it is this assistant. And I genuinely think that if Android fans, there are so many things to love about this, but as this assistant becomes smarter, I think that could actually pull people away from the likes of the iPhone. And also, because it's set on Pixel, it'll pull people away from other Android devices as well.
Yeah, definitely. So do you think that the home assistant would pull you away from the Amazon Echo instead? Do you think the search engine function is what definitely makes it smarter?
I think the problem is we need to have some proper time with both of them. The demo of Alexa impressed me. The demo of Home blew my mind. So I think it'd be really interesting to see how the two compete. Amazon stole a bit of a charge by announcing the Alexa first, and obviously that's available now in the UK. Google said that Home isn't available in the UK now and hasn't actually given us a date when it will be coming out. So it's really frustrating because you know there's going to be loads of people who want to get their hands on it and they can't.
Do you reckon we could get two together and either get, you know, Alexa and Google Assistant to argue, or, you know, get them to race to answer our questions?
Like a personal assistant death match.
I don't know if that's like horrible or quite exciting. Maybe horrible.
What about the final thing? What about the headset? I think this looks really smart, but it's not as comfy as they kind of made it out to be, is it?
Well, when they first said about it being made of fabric and it's got cushioning, it's sort of obvious. You just think, actually, why haven't other headsets included this in it? The only problem is it's still really heavy. So it's more comfortable than the likes of HTC Vive or the Oculus because they are, I mean, they do have some sort of rubberized cushioning on there, but this feels a lot more comfortable on your face. But it just, it is, you can't get away from that fact that your head keeps wanting to go forward because it is quite heavy. But the demonstrations they gave us were brilliant, and how easy it is to use as well. So I did Harry Potter in virtual reality, and that was incredible.
Yeah, that definitely was the thing during the stream which picked my interest. I was like, Harry Potter would be really exciting doing in VR.
And they went, during one of the demonstrations, they made me play a game where I had to race a circular cow against a circular pig, and you use the controller. The remote control actually has a controller in the game. So it's almost like, it's a step up from cardboard, and it's not aimed at the hardcore gamers like Oculus Rift and HTC Vive is, but it has enough in there to really get people involved in VR and sort of unlock that potential.
Yeah, and I do you remember what the price point is in Britain? It's like $79 or something America?
It's so cheap. I think it's £69 in the UK.
Right. Well, you compare that to Oculus, which is whatever, kind of like between $500 and $600, and then on top of that, the super-powered PC you've got to have. You just think, you know, to get something that's, you know, even part of the way there and a huge step above cardboard is quite exciting for something that costs so little.
And that's the thing, it doesn't feel like a budget headset when you've got it on.
It doesn't look like one as well.
It's really smart, and it the way that it, like, and because it comes in these different colours and because it comes in fabrics, suddenly it becomes a bit more of a fashion accessory. I wouldn't wear it out on the streets, but it does suddenly become more of a, why does something have to be practical without looking good? And I think Google has always been quite good at that, and I think they've really nailed it with the headset.
Yeah, maybe this Christmas will be the Christmas of the VR headset.
So, story number two, over to you, Matt Reynolds.
So, in a nutshell, fish have accents. So this comes off the back of some work by a group of researchers led by Steve Simpson, who's a marine biologist at the University of Exeter. He spent the last 15 years listening to fish, and basically he's been studying what happens when fish with different dialects or accents collide, different fish species collide, as warming seas are driving fish species further north.
So fish speak.
Yeah, so yeah, I kind of glossed over that. But by the way, fish chat to each other all the time. So we all know that underwater mammals like dolphins and whales, they whistle and squeal to communicate. But other fish species talk too. And cod, which is the subject of this study, they're particularly chatty. So they produce a variety of noises using their swim bladder, which is kind of like a, you know, an inbuilt flotation device. And they use these sounds to establish territories, raise alarm if there's a predator, or attract mates. And it turns out that individual groups and individual species of cod have developed their own regional accents because they've essentially occupied the same breeding grounds in the Atlantic for thousands or hundreds or potentially thousands of years. But now we're finding that as these cod that are in the kind of mid or more southern Atlantic start to migrate further north because the temperature is getting warmer and they're like, oh, I need to get to colder seas, that these accents are starting to clash with other cod that are living up there already.
So what's the difference between the accents then?
So I'm not sure if this reflects, you know, our human accents, but American cod, they sound deeper, they have like more short thumping sounds, while European cod, they're kind of higher pitch, you know, higher frequency, and they have more prolonged growls. It's not just cod that have an accent or an animal with an accent. We know already that loads of different animals have regional accents, and this includes cows, dogs, whales, and of course, humans. So there is also a little bit of a serious side. I mean, this is fun and fish accents are very serious. But part of the reason why they're doing this study is to look at the impact that human noise has on fish species. So the researchers already know that motorboats and water traffic could be having a serious impact on the behaviour and stress levels of fish. So basically, seawater is hundreds of times more dense than air, so sound travels much, much faster, and it travels further too. That's part of the reason why whales can talk over such large territories. So a humpback whale can talk over like 100 miles. You know, talk to people, talk to other whales 100 miles away. And because of this, fish are really, really susceptible to noise pollution, stuff like a boat going overhead, you know, divers rustling around in coral reefs. And, you know, that's a really big area. So researchers already know that in coral reefs, fish are, you know, particularly badly affected, but also they're now starting to study the areas around Britain to see, you know, are we upsetting these fish?
So what are they going to do with the information? What are they going to do next?
So what they're going to do, this is quite fun. So they're going to build an extensive sound library that records the British marine soundscape. So Simpson and his team have already started to record underwater the waters around Newcastle and the Clyde. And they're basically going to build that around with other parts of the UK and start to give us more of an idea of what, you know, what conversations fish are having, but also, and almost more importantly, how much of this conversation is obscured by all those sounds that are happening either above the water or just in the water and that are kind of down to us.
I mean, I guess it's quite ignorant of us to just assume that we're the only animals to have accents.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I never really thought of that.
What about Finding Nemo? The fish have Australian accents there.
Well, and so clownfish were one of the first fish that researchers realised had accents. So Nemo is a clownfish.
No way.
So I don't know. Did Nemo have an Australian accent?
No, Nemo didn't have an Australian accent. It was...
The turtles,
right? The turtles were Australian.
Yeah.
And then obviously the seagulls had really funny accents as well.
So actually this... Yeah, sorry about that. But the research is irrelevant because we already know from Finding Nemo that fish definitely have accents.
And over to you, Amelia.
So this week, Facebook Messenger launched their secret conversations. If you use Facebook's Messenger app, you can now have secret chats with your friends that will self-destruct. You might have noticed that earlier this year, WhatsApp launched end-to-end encryption on its app. So it meant that the messages that were sent between you and other people couldn't be intercepted. So because of this, Facebook started testing end-to-end encryption on the Messenger app in July, and it's now completed the full rollout. So if you're worried about, you know, other people intercepting your conversations, like law enforcement or intelligence agencies or even just Facebook itself, now that the app update has arrived, you don't have to think about that anymore.
And I mean, it's pretty topical at the moment with the Yahoo allegedly spying on people's emails.
Exactly.
Knowing that even if someone came to Facebook and said, I want to read these emails, that they wouldn't even be able to give them up.
Yeah, it definitely like makes you feel more secure as a user. So they did this through a service using the Signal protocol developed by Open Whisper Systems, which adds the end-to-end encryption to messages so that they can't be intercepted.
So does that mean every single message I send now on Messenger is encrypted?
Well, actually not. You need to opt into the secret message aspect. It's not enabled by default, and Facebook have been criticised for this. So both you and the person you're messaging get a device key that you can use to verify that the messages are end-to-end encrypted, and you can set a timer to have your messages disappear from the conversation. So when you update your Messenger app, you will see a secret option on the top right of the new message screen, and if you tap secret, and then your messages start being secret from then. But we need to stress that it's not something that happens automatically. You can't assume that all your messages are 100% secure, even though Facebook say they are. Unless they're end-to-end encrypted, you can't be 100% positive of that.
Okay, so I mean, the self-destruct thing sounds a little bit like Snapchat.
Well, this is the thing. Obviously, Snapchat had the ethereal hook on the market. But it's funny because now Snapchat has moved into Snapchat memories and things like that. Snapchat is getting more concrete and other apps seem to be moving away from that, which is quite interesting. So on Facebook's new... on Apple's new message app for iOS 10, you can send messages in invisible ink, and then the person on the other side has to press them to get them to form the real message. But every time you go back to that message, it's in invisible ink again. So if someone didn't know how to look at it, your message would technically still be safe.
So what do we think of this? Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea?
The way that I've seen it is that if a friend owes me money and I need to send them my bank details in order for them to send me the money back, you can do that completely safely. You know, you have the end-to-end encryption in there. You know that no one else is going to find that, get that information. And that's is quite good as a user. You know, you always worry about putting your bank details in on the internet and who's going to find it. So that aspect is quite good. And then also with the news about Yahoo this week, you know, people might be feeling like, I don't want the government snooping on my emails. This is a way of kind of getting around that.
See, when I first heard this news, I was a little bit cynical. I was like, well, what's the worst that could happen? I mean, at the very sort of basic, people could use it for cheating, or they could use it for quite relatively mundane or minor things. But equally, you could have terrorist organisations using these platforms to discuss these really, really private conversations and dangerous conversations.
Well, that's like what Telegram is used for. That's an end-to-end encryption messaging app. And we, in the last issue of Wired, actually, we have a really interesting feature, which is to do with what a journalist for a site made a relationship with someone who is working as part of Anonymous to try and intercept Daesh's messages and find out what they're doing. And he does that by a lot by hanging out in Telegram chat rooms. And I know that US Wired did another feature kind of similar, and the journalist the same. She found the Telegram chat rooms and found the different messages, and they could find out almost when terrorist attacks were going to happen depending on the messages that were sending out, which is really scary. And I guess obviously with Telegram it's a bit more open, whereas with this, but you do have to have the keys to get in, but with this it's completely secure and can't be intercepted. So I don't know, that is a bit scary.
Do we know if Facebook, say, keep a record of these, or if the government needed to get hold of these conversations, they could be somewhere? So are they, what I don't get is, are they deleted for the user, or are they deleted forever on the internet?
Deleted forever, like Snapchat.
Okay.
And that's the key. So yeah. Facebook will already say, look, when you send a message on Messenger, or when you send a within your profile, technically it's meant to, especially Messenger, is meant to be encrypted anyway. This is end-to-end encryption. So this is talking about only you and the person you're sending it to can see it. So the normal encryption could protect you from the company or from hackers, whereas this is being a lot more specific and just saying it's very reliant on your device and your key.
Yeah, and you can't use it on Facebook online as well. It's only on the messaging app, and it's only on the device that's sending the message and the one device that's reading it. And then you can do the set a timer so that message deletes after an hour or whatever, and then it's gone, like Snapchat.
It's interesting because it's almost like Facebook. So that means if you want to, you know, send super secure messages, either you use something like Telegram or you use Facebook Messenger. Whereas before, Facebook Messenger was always, you know, partly online, it was chatting to your mates. So it seems also they're trying to be, you know, a bit more serious. And also, yeah, kind of you know, steal a little bit of market from, you know, iMessage or WhatsApp and things. So pretty bold move. It's an interesting path to go down.
Well, that's the thing. So obviously Facebook own WhatsApp now. So and WhatsApp introduced end-to-end encryption. So every time you go on a message now that was switched on by default. So every time, if I was to message you, Matt, if it was the first time we'd had that conversation, it would just have a little message to say, oh, by the way, this conversation is end-to-end encrypted. And you can go in and you can find out exactly what that means. So I'm not surprised that Facebook has introduced this to Messenger at all, but I think you're absolutely right. It's sort of pushing the app towards a different route. Coming up next, we chat to photographer Benedict Redgrave, who takes us on an unprecedented tour inside NASA for our latest issue.
This year, Wired launched the Wired Audi Innovation Awards to celebrate the people achieving extraordinary things, from AI to design and science to social innovation. The nominees have been decided, and the awards will be handed out at a ceremony on November 9th. To find out more, visit wired.co.uk, search for the hashtag Wired Audi Awards, and pick up the January issue of the magazine, where we'll be showcasing the work of the winners.
Welcome back. As we mentioned earlier, we've been joined in the studio now by Benedict Redgrove, who shot all the fantastic pictures across our 16-page spread in this month's issue of Wired. He went inside NASA, looked all around their future projects, their past projects, and stuff that's going on presently as well. So, Benedict, fabulous to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about what you did in this project and how you got into NASA?
So, originally, I mean, like the first shoot we did for this project was about 18 months ago. It'd taken over 5 years to get the thing going, really. We'd been emailing and trying to find the right department. And being a government department, it's quite a tricky organisation to get into. Plus, obviously the general secrecy of it. And most of it, because it's funded by the American taxpayers, open to the public, so they get a certain amount of access anyway. But there's certain areas that they don't get into. So we were kind of restricted to what their schedule was. So we set out a sort of list of items that we wanted to cover, suits and craft, and then we met with various people who worked at the different organisations, like at Johnson and at Kennedy, and finally got a yes to say, okay, come in, we can see you, and we'll run through the shoot, and what is it you want to photograph? So our first part was to go into the International Space Station trainer, which is, it's a life-size mock-up of the International Space Station, and they have the different modules laid out. So the astronauts get familiarity. So there's, it's sort of laid out in the correct pattern, slightly off a little bit. And so they can practice walking through and where they want to be if you want to get from one part to another, especially if there's an emergency or something. Even the detail is quite incredible, actually, because even down to where one pod will join another pod, they'll sometimes put a sticker on different mission stickers. Every mission has its own patch and sticker. So they'll if they put one up on the space station, they'll put it in exactly the same spot on the trainer. So if you're looking, if there's an emergency and you see something, it doesn't matter what it is, something that's vaguely familiar, you will recognise it from your days on the trainer. The difference between the training module and the actual space station itself is there's very little computer laptops or iPads or cables, and when you look at the footage from the space station, it's just littered with stuff everywhere. So the space station shots that I've got are very sort of clean and sort of devoid of any technology apart from what's on the walls already. So we shot there first, and that was one day just shooting in three or four of the modules, and then we went back the next trip and shot the rest of it. But spending a day in there is really, it's quite an eerie thing. You're devoid of any idea of what's of any daylight, obviously, because you're inside another building, and because you're just in this kind of box, basically, you start to sort of get an idea of what they would feel. You know, if you're doing 6 months or whatever up there, that's a long time, and it's quite a small place. I think they say it's the same size as a 6-bedroom house, roughly, but obviously in a 6-bedroom house you can go out. And you can look out. I mean, you can look out of the space station, but slightly different. So it was kind of an odd scenario to be in. So we started there and we shot in the same building as the International Space Station trainer, is the Space Shuttle trainer, which they used to have two. They had one that was standing upright, and you would get in and you could do your launch practice in there. And they've got another one that's on the ground. So you just practice, you know, going through flight plans, and they do different scenarios.
And were there any particular favourites for you personally that you shot?
Yes, I mean, there's an awful lot. There's been some incredible things. One of the things was Atlantis. The first time I saw Space Shuttle Atlantis, it's like having a sort of semi-religious experience, is the nearest I can explain to it. I guess it's when someone meets their icon for the first time. It's, you know, it's a footballer or a pop star or a film star. You know, you see people sort of shaking with kind of excitement. Or kids do anyway, and I kind of felt the same. I saw this thing, and it blew my mind. I mean, that's, you know, that thing's been hurtling around space on however many 30 odd missions, 40 missions or something, and 125 million miles it's travelled, and you know, 17,500 miles an hour orbiting the Earth. It's just an incredible piece of kit, and I just was completely taken aback when I saw that. And then another one was, and I sort of weren't really shooting, but we were chatting to the mission controller over at when they were working on the space station. And so we were standing by the mission control watching the International Space Station, watching a sunset view from the International Space Station as it moved around. So that was pretty cool.
So what was it like doing the different shots? I mean, how did you set up shooting a rocket compared to like shooting the Valkyrie, for example?
The sort of smallest thing we shot was a piece of moon rock. Which is probably the Gemini rock, which is, Genesis rock, which is probably 5 inches long, 6 inches long. And then the biggest thing would be Saturn V, I guess, or the space shuttle, you know, between those two. And yeah, I mean, they're a different process, really. So one was, the camera we used was camera called an ALPA, and you sort of shoot in different segments with using that X and Y axis, and you shoot different parts to make up one picture. So it's the same process, really, just with slightly different lenses, and the furthest you can get away from something to try and make it sort of fit in the frame. Tricky. They're quite tricky things. You've got to be realistic about what you're going to get and your expectations are for each one. But we're limited to the size of the places that we're shooting in, really.
Particularly because, obviously, you said you shot the replica of the International Space Station is a building within a building. What was it like doing, like, lighting and things like that to get the best kind of image from that?
Because of the time restrictions that we're on, we don't tend to light anything. So unless it's something like Valkyrie or the Robonauts or some of the vehicles, we can light those, and some of the capsules as well. But normally you're on a very tight timeline. So, you know, this isn't for our relaxation purposes, and for, you know, the NASA's not there for editorial purposes. It's there to build craft and train astronauts and you know, learn. And so the time that we're in there means time that astronauts can't be in there. So we've got to be efficient and fast. So it's literally plan, get on and do it. So we're working hard, fast each day. There's not really anything to stop. You don't really, you know, you might have a lunch break for 20 minutes, but really it's just get out, go and grab something and then get on with it. And long days in quite intense environments, because you need to make sure that what you're doing is quick, on time. You're not shooting things that you shouldn't be seeing. Which is, you know, there's a couple of points where we've been in environments where we have to be very careful about what we're shooting, and they have to get things approved by NASA security, and yeah, so it's quite tight.
And what has it taught you about the whole culture of NASA, really, being inside this massive organisation?
They are incredible people that work there. You know, they're all, everyone that is there is a sort of specialist in their own field, and they're all there to do what they love and what they're very good at, and it's for a sort of hive mentality, you know, in that we're all trying to do something, or they're all trying to do something for the betterment of mankind. And I think that's something that people need to sort of bear in mind, when that, you know, it's not just the excitement of space travel. They're doing this because we have a thirst for knowledge. That's a human, it's human trait that we want to understand things, and they're the people that are helping us to supply that and understand that, that they get that knowledge.
If you had the opportunity to go to space, you know, if Elon Musk does take us to Mars, would you go?
It's a good question, and it's one I've asked myself a few times, especially when we're standing on the space station. I think when the space shuttle days were going, I think I would love to have gone up in that, because that was an incredible craft. And there was quite a lot of room inside it as well. It's quite a roomy thing. Apollo craft is pretty tight. And if you looked inside a Soyuz capsule, they're really pretty small. So I don't think I'd fancy going up in one of those. Maybe one of the newer ones. Yeah, I mean, Orion, that's a nice size module, a Soyuz capsule. And the same with, I think, with the Dragon as well. It's supposed to be the same.
And obviously your work going here, as we mentioned earlier in the show, is going into a bigger project. Can you tell us a bit about that and where you go next, really?
Yes, so this is... The whole plan has always been to shoot all of the spacesuits, all of the craft, as much of the facilities as we can, from NASA's very beginning all the way through to where they are now and where they're going. That's the important part, because there's a very, you know, there's a similar story between the Apollo era and where we are now, even in the shape of the rockets and the craft that are going there. They're sort of scaled up versions, and obviously with a lot more technology and a lot more know-how. So the project really needs to show both those parts. So this isn't really a part one. It's just a part of the project that we've shot so far, based on that schedule that we're allowed certain times to be in certain areas. So still to shoot, we've got some of the historic suits. We've got the SLS rocket, which is the new rocket which Orion will be on top of, and then all the small test facilities, and try and get over to Rocketdyne and a few other people, some of the other suppliers who've worked with NASA for a long time. Because there's all, you know, these craft aren't just NASA. They're with Boeing, they're with Lockheed, Bigelow. There's lots of different companies who supply and work with NASA closely. So probably two more years, and then that's going to end in 2018 with the launch of SLS and Orion, where they're going to be doing taking a lunar orbit, basically, and that will be the final shot in the project. And then we'll be showing that as an exhibition and book. So the exhibition will have very, very large size print. So spacesuits will be life size, if not a little bigger, just so you get the sort of heroic awe of the majesty of the people that are in them. lunar rover and things like that will be tried to be print life size as well. And then there'll be a book as well, which will come out as well.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to that in 2018 and beyond. Thank you very much for joining us, Benedict.
Thank you very much.
So don't forget, tickets are still on sale for our Wired Security event on October the 20th, and the latest issue is on sale now. All the information is available on wired.co.uk. And as always, let us know all your thoughts on the podcast, the magazine, or just life in general on our Facebook page, Twitter at Wired UK, or message us directly. I'm on Twitter as at Vicky Wollaston.
I'm on Twitter at AmeliaX1.
And I'm at MattSReynolds1.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.